Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the ETF Show. I'm Tom Bailey, ETF's editor at Interactive Investor. So today we're joined by Rahul Bhushan, co-founder of Rise ETF, and Felix Bourdeau, the Chief Sustainability Officer at Sustainable Market Strategies, which recently collaborated with Rise to launch a new ETF, which we're going to start with. So to start, you guys recently launched the Rise Environmental Impact 100 UCITS ETF, with its ticker being LIFE, L-I-F-E. So this ETF aims to invest in 100 companies that are helping to tackle climate change or other environmental problems. So perhaps it's best to start with a brief outline of what this ETF aims to do.
The LIFE ETF is really about environmental impact. So it's the first environmental impact ETF to be launched in Europe. And the focus is to really invest in the top 100 environmental impact companies. And so contrary to other funds you may find out there that focus on either ESG scores or carbon footprint or something like that, and they take more of a top-down approach where they construct the fund based on a certain target, they want a certain score or they want a certain carbon footprint, we kind of flipped it on its head and took a bottom-up approach and really looked at what are the 100 companies that have the potential to solve the environmental problems that we are facing. And so it's beyond carbon, it's water pollution, it's air pollution, it's the circular economy, it's biodiversity. And by looking at all of the environmental issues that we're trying to solve, we noticed that the EU taxonomy was actually pretty far ahead in developing their taxonomy on environmental issues. And so we aligned the theme and the sectors of the fund with the EU taxonomy. And so these are the six environmental objectives that they have. And so we built the fund around those six environmental objectives, and we developed a few more subsectors. And so it's a really, broad environmental fund. And it's fairly unique in the space.
So as you said, there's different segments to the 100 companies in the ETF. Can you break down which of the segments are and say how many companies are in typically one of the segments?
Sure. So the six environmental objectives of the EU taxonomy are the climate change mitigation, climate change adaptation, the protection of water, protection of biodiversity, circular economy, and pollution control. And so these were the environmental objectives. And then we broke down the climate change mitigation into further subsectors because it's such a broad theme. So we've added themes like the electric vehicles, clean energy, etc. So we have in total we have 10 subsectors, and the breakdown it's when you look at the subsectors, we actually have a fairly good representation of all the sectors: circular economy, water, and climate change are well represented. Some themes are a little bit more difficult to invest in right now, so themes like climate change adaptation is notoriously difficult to find publicly listed companies invested in that. It's typically the role of governments and NGOs and other more public sectors, but we still found some companies, and we actually think that it's a theme that will become increasingly popular. So the whole nature-based solutions, biodiversity, protection is going to be, the next big environmental objective for a lot of, companies. And so we wanted to already have a good methodology to assess the impact potential of those companies, so that when they actually come on board and they do IPOs and they become investable, we have a good solution.
So I want you to walk us through how you decide which companies go in which part of the segment. So what, just from your starting point, what's the entire universe of stocks you pick from, and then how you judge those stocks for how they should fit into these different segments?
So the way we populated the universe and ranked the companies, we use basically two scores. So one is the thematic purity score, where we look at what percentage of revenues of a company could be associated with a certain environmental objective. And so a company that has some solutions for water cleaning, etc., they would get a certain, we would look at all publicly available documents, and we would try to map the revenues from that company to the environmental objectives. And so that would give us a purity score. And then we would look at the impact potential of that company. So the impact score is actually broken down into a few elements. So we look at the impact potential of the theme itself. So for example, hydrogen is a very potentially impactful technology. We know it would solve a lot of problems. So any companies invested in hydrogen would get a pretty high impact score, but the economic feasibility of hydrogen is still difficult to be proven. So they would get a bit of a lesser score there, because we know it's a impactful technology, but a bit less likely to become quickly. And then the third part is basically the leadership, of that company within that space. So certain companies are better positioned to benefit from, the potential of a technology. And so we would look at the various internal policies of that company, the level of investment in R&D, the number of patents they have, et cetera. And based on those factors, we basically built an impact score that then ranked the entire universe, and then we picked the top 100 to invest in.
Are there any companies in the ETF or index you'd want to highlight?
There are some companies, and that's where sometimes we stand out compared to other funds, is that you won't find a lot of information technology companies in our fund, because since we focus on the impact potential, so more of a forward-looking view of environmental impact, we actually invest in companies that are in these industries that require a lot of investment and a lot of R&D. And so we have some, for example, a lot of industrials, companies in, for example, in energy efficiency. We have companies like, Johnson Controls, who developed a lot of, energy efficiency solutions. In the, engineering side of things, we have companies like Arcadis, which is one of the few companies that is really, has a great experience in nature-based solutions and developing solutions to adapt to the climate change impacts that we're seeing. So they, for example, they developed a lot of projects on sponge cities, where they designed ways for cities to really deal with the increased risks of floods and of water. Filtration, so natural filtration systems and stuff like that. So this is a good example for the climate, resilience and the nature-based solutions. And then in water technologies, there's Kurita, a Japanese very innovative company that has been around for almost 100 years, and they really develop very innovative solutions that have, that have a very great impact on people, because we're talking clean water for people, but also cleaning all the water that the heavy industry uses.
So you already mentioned kind of how this ETF differs from other funds and products in the ESG impact investing space. And obviously, it's a very hot topic right now, the idea of greenwashing and how lots of funds claiming to be in this sort of impact, ethical, environmental investing area don't quite live up to the promises. I would you walk us through your thoughts on what greenwashing is and how, you know, you've ensured that this product is not a greenwash product.
Sure. And yeah, that's a very, that's a great question and very topical these days. We're seeing a lot of discussions around that. And, you know, the main issue on, you know, greenwashing and for us as a firm, we're really specialized in environmental, you know, technologies. And then we've kind of added the, you know, the financial kind of side to our firm. So we're really able, I think, to, you know, to screen for companies that, you know, hopefully stay away from the whole greenwashing thing. And one way of doing this is not using basically standard ESG scoring that, you know, so many people use a little bit blindly. And, you know, because this is a little bit easier for companies to play that score. They can, without changing that much, they can increase their score substantially. And so we really want to take a forward-looking approach, and we basically ignore all of the ESG scores. We use it more as an input, and then we mostly focus on the potential of the, you know, technologies and the services that is, you know, that companies are providing, to see if that in itself will solve or not the environmental issues that we are facing. And so I think that obviously requires more work and more knowledge and more expertise. And that's what we bring to the table.
Thanks. So my next question is for Rahul. So it's all very convincing, but why is an index tracking ETF the best structure for the strategy? There's obviously, you could input this in different ways with different products, different approaches, passive, active. Why an index tracking ETF, Rahul?
So I think there's two core reasons. One is we're still in the relatively early stages of the green revolution. And this is not going to happen over a decade. This is going to be a multi-decade investment story. And so for us, you know, taking an active approach today felt a little too soon, because what you're effectively doing is you're taking a universe of environment, companies associated with the environment. Let's say there's an index out there of 300, 400 names, and you're basically trying to decide which 30 companies are going to win, you know, 20 years from now. And for us, that didn't feel like it was the right time to basically make those kinds of long-term or take those kind of long-term views and have those sort of long-term convictions. So for us, the sensible approach was, okay, let's just find the top 100 companies in the environmental universe. And let's allocate to the companies by reference to the extent of their potential future environmental impact. And so that's what's happening in this fund is we're picking 100 companies, the top 100 companies from that broader list of companies within the environmental sector, and really looking for those with the ability to make the greatest contribution towards environmental sustainability within their respective subsector. And Felix talked a little bit about the subsectors. So that was the process here. The second element, I think, for why we chose to go systematic or passive or index-based, if you will, is the discipline it brings. So, you know, when you're investing in an area like the environment or toward environmental sustainability in general, you want to bring a level of discipline to the investment process, which isn't influenced by short-term behaviors and short-term convictions, perhaps. And so the index approach, in our view, removes emotion from the equation and implements a series of systematic rules that are fully transparent, are publicly available. We make all of our documents publicly available. Anybody can go on our website and look at what the investment strategy is doing on a day-to-day. It's documented in the index methodology. All the scores Felix talked about are also documented in the index methodology, as well as the subsectors that we're investing in, as well as the environmental objectives. So everything is in there. And as an investor, you have a transparent methodology, a transparent investment process, and also the certainty that, you know, there's some discipline to the process, because again, this isn't a product where you go in and you walk away with twice the amount of money, you know, 6 months down the line. This is a product that you go in with the conviction that these environmental companies are going to be much bigger in 5 years, a decade from now, than they are today.
Okay, so moving on to some of Rise ETF's other products. So it was about a year ago you launched the Rise Education Tech and Digital Learning ETF, ticker LEARN, spelled L-E-R-N. Do you want to just briefly walk us through the kind of ETF strategy here?
Sure. So the LEARN ETF is a fund that's trying to invest in the digitization of education. So we saw during the pandemic that a lot of students shifted to, in the same way as a lot of workers shifted from work to work from home, a lot of students also shifted to learn from home. And that was true, you know, irrespective of whether the students were in sort of K-12, you know, higher education. But also we saw a big uptake last year of employees, you know, already working for particular institutions, now working from home, trying to further develop their skills. And there's a number of companies that have also emerged in that sort of workforce subsector where, you know, which is really truly about this idea of lifelong learning. Because gone are the days where you could pick up a degree at university and expect to have one job for, you know, 30 years until you retire, and effectively just working for one company for that entire period. I think with the inherent disruption and digitization that we're seeing in society today, it's never been more important for people to just move away from that sort of thinking and really think about learning as a lifelong as a lifelong thing. So you've actually seen a number of companies operating within that workforce subsector, which is really about upskilling, reskilling people, and also developing people's softer skills as they move it into leadership or management type of positions. So we've seen a big boost to the revenues of these companies, particularly in the West, over the last few years. So that was something that we were watching, and what we wanted to effectively do is to capture all of these opportunities, which really are about delivering education digitally in both the West as well as in the East within one investment fund. And that's what we did in the LEARN fund. We launched it in October, and it's been, I think, you know, almost a year now that the fund has been live.
So obviously, launching a digital education focused ETF a few months into a pandemic that forced schools and university students to all start learning from home. And also, as you mentioned, the trend towards those in the workforce also learning at home during the lockdowns and stuff. It seems quite fortuitous. Was this ETF in the works before COVID and lockdowns? Or did you perhaps launch it in response to this?
So we actually had it in development from, I think it was December 2019 is when we chose to explore the industry a little further. There were already actually some champions that were sort of visible within the edtech sector back then, you know, even prior to the pandemic. Obviously, they saw a big boost over the course of last year in particular. But you know, some of these companies are you know, we're already pretty established names. You know, the Chegg's of the world, the 2U's of the world in the US, these were already established names. A friend of mine actually sold a company to Chegg, you know, in 2011. So he set up a company back in 2010 while he was at Stanford, and he basically grew it to a particular size, and then he sold it to Chegg. So I was actually aware of Chegg for almost 10 years. But it was interesting to see this company go public and then just go from strength to strength to strength. And so we've always sort of tried to keep an ear to the ground and look at what the venture capitalists are doing and look for thematic ideas there. And this one really sprung from that same process. Like you said, it was a bit fortuitous that, you know, we ended up beginning to develop this thematic fund right around the same time as the pandemic was happening. And then, you know, the pandemic boost, so to speak, happened, and these companies experienced, you know, quite a decent surge in their revenues over the course of 2020.
Oh, of course. While there's been an online and digital enabled learning boom, one of the biggest markets for it in recent months has been having a bit of a tough time. I'm talking about obviously China. So recent months, the Chinese government has launched a crackdown on digital learning for school students in particular, and has taken a serious toll on the share price of some big names in the sector, which are included in the ETF's portfolio. Do you want to walk us through what's going on here?
Yeah, it's a really good point, and certainly one we're talking to investors about quite a lot. In the last couple of weeks, you know, this idea of regulatory risk that can be embedded in virtually any investment product out there, but certainly products that have greater exposure to let's say emerging markets. You know, Argentina has defaulted a number of times, and you know, China in this case, you know, there seems to be a lot of geopolitical tension, of course, but at the same time, China has been cracking down on its tech industry, perhaps because it's getting too big and they want to rein in, you know, the so-called tech billionaires, or perhaps, you know, they want to assert, you know, a certain level of control through, you know, quasi-nationalism of certain companies. But I think the biggest story as it relates to edtech in China really is them trying to find a sort of an antidote to their demographic problem. So much like in many countries in the West, China today has a big demographic problem. Its population is getting old, and they have way more men than they have women. It's also becoming increasingly expensive to live in China and to have a, you know, a decent enough affordable lifestyle in China, because property prices are rising and the country has developed rather quickly, and not in all cases where wages have kept pace. So there is this demographic issue which they're now experiencing, which is also a result, of course, of the one child policy which they had for a very long time to control their population. So now they're trying to effectively reverse that. And one of the industries they've been focused on is edtech, specifically because a lot of Chinese parents send their children to after-school tutoring classes. And like you said, Tom, a lot of the companies within the edtech sector are in China and effectively catering to this after-school tutoring market and weekend tutoring specifically. And so the Chinese government has looked at this and said, well, look, it's becoming really expensive for people to have children because education costs are also rising quite rapidly. And over and above that, we have to, these parents are having to send their children to these weekend schools, because if they don't, all the other parents are doing it and their children are going to fall behind. So to encourage people to have more children effectively, they're now trying to look for new ways to effectively encourage procreation within the country. And so you effectively have them now eyeing this edtech sector, and they're going to be imposing, you know, quite strict regulation and trying to rein in the sector. And one of the things they've said is that they want to turn K-12 education, so the early stage or early childhood to sort of end of high school education, to non-profit status. So effectively, you know, not allowing private companies to compete in that space, to the end objective being, of course, to lower the cost of the child's education, and so that's been interesting, but also quite painful to see, you know, within the fund, because it's affected the share price of a lot of these Chinese edtech companies, and so the fund as a result has taken a hit, and so At the moment, the fund has roughly, you know, 25 or a little less than 25% exposure to Chinese companies. And it's we expect this to be sort of a re-rating phase for the industry, because a lot of these Chinese companies are, well, number one, they're going to have to divest from the K-12 subsector, which they're involved in. And as they do that, they're going to have to reorient their businesses towards more higher education and more workforce-oriented learning. And so as that transition happens, we'll see some, you know, quite a lot of M&A activity, most likely within the Chinese edtech industry, but also, you know, these companies trying to effectively find their feet again. The long-term thesis for us within the fund remains intact, because, you know, ultimately this is a global story. And so if, you know, or the representation of China shrinks within the fund, the representation of other countries, we expect to grow over time. Because we're already seeing, you know, this year we've seen a number of IPOs. We saw Coursera, we saw KeyPath in Australia, we saw Europe's first unicorn out of Austria within the edtech space. So there's no slowdown in edtech activity, but what we're expecting to see is a shift away from edtech funding, you know, going into companies in China towards perhaps other emerging markets, and then also in the US and Europe.
Interesting. Moving on to another notable ETF of yours, it's the Rise Medical Cannabis and Life Science ETF, its ticker being FLWR, I pronounced flower. So this ETF's performed very well since it launched. I was wondering if you could walk through why you think investors should invest in cannabis.
Absolutely. So we've always seen the cannabis story as being effectively three waves. The first wave being the Canadian LPs wave, where you saw this big period or 2-3 year period of irrational, let's call it exuberance. This is sort of 2016, 2017, where you basically saw a flurry of IPOs on the back of the legalization of recreational cannabis in Canada. And all these IPOs coming to market and their share price, you know, going straight to the moon. And that was met with a lot of expectations from investors for these companies to deliver. And of course, they didn't deliver. And so 2018 was a big re-rating phase for the Canadian LPs. And then began sort of the second wave of cannabis, as we like to call it, which is really the US MSO wave, which also ties into some of the more liberalization, the liberalization of cannabis at the state level, which we saw over the course of 2018-19, where a lot of states independently went and legalized cannabis for medicinal as well as for recreational use across the country. Today, you know, there's 50 states in the United States, and more than 35 states have some form of legalized medical cannabis program. So that sort of state legalization wave really began at sort of 2018, 2019, and really has been accelerating since. Just this year, you know, since the Biden election, we're talking about 11 states having passed cannabis reform. So, you know, that's you know, less than a year. And so we are seeing this U.S. MSO wave. When we say MSO, we mean U.S. multi-state operators. And that's been an interesting wave to see. Because the U.S. Represents a significantly bigger market than Canada. You know, just the potential market in Florida alone is as big as Canada. So, you know, the U.S. potential, the potential of the U.S. cannabis market, both for medicinal as well as adult use, has quite a lot of potential. So that's the sort of second wave. We think that's moving and happening right now. We also see the third wave emerging at the same time, which is really what we like to denote the pharmaceutical cannabis wave, which is really the efficacy-led medicinal wave, where you know, we are actually going to see a number of, and we're already seeing, in fact, and investors can go into our fund and look at some of the names, but we're already seeing a number of companies popping up that are trying to understand the more than 110 different cannabinoids, flavonoids, terpenes within the cannabis plant and understand what their medical properties are, and then try to create both synthetic as well as non-synthetic medicines that can help people. And this is, I think, one of the most interesting areas within the space for us. Certainly from a European perspective, this was the area that our investors were most interested in, was really the sort of pharmaceutical subset of companies within the cannabis space. And so these are the companies we've packaged in a fund. The other dimension to the third wave, which is, again, the pharmaceutical wave, is that this is the one we expect to go global. It's hard to take a long-term view or have a high conviction view on how fast recreational cannabis or adult use cannabis goes global. But it's far easier to have a view on how fast the medical cannabis wave goes global. You know, today we already have more than 70 countries with a legalized cannabis program. That compares to, you know, less than 10 just a decade ago. And the number of countries that are passing cannabis reform, liberalizing and destigmatizing this plant, and really starting to rethink how it can be used for medicinal purposes, and then getting involved in that industry is rapidly accelerating. And so it's an exciting place for us. But that's really the backstory, if you will, for this fund and why we created it.
No, it's very interesting. But of course, cannabis remains an illegal drug in the United Kingdom. And so I can imagine some listeners might be a bit confused about how you can legally invest in a product which is illegal in this country. So I wonder if you could talk through the legal side of all this.
Sure. So medical cannabis is legal in the UK. So we're investing in global medical cannabis companies. Nothing that we're investing in is plant touching. You know, this fund has been approved by the Central Bank of Ireland, the FCA, you know, all the exchange, the London Stock Exchange. We've had legal advice when we were putting the fund together, so as to ensure we implemented a process to get all these individual regulatory and legal bodies comfortable with the fund. So this is not a fund that took us, you know, 2 weeks. This is a fund that took us the best part of 2 years. When we put the fund together, we were aware that it would take us 2 years, but it was quite important for us to be early to the opportunity because, you know, a lot of the time with these kind of new and emerging sectors, if you get in too late, you've kind of lost that initial momentum. And so what we wanted to really do here is create a vehicle that allowed investors to get in early and access the opportunity early. Like you said, it's been a really positively performing ETF this year. We think the secular growth story is still intact. You know, what's interesting about these type of thematic opportunities that are new, in our view, is that they do provide these sort of asymmetric risk returns because, you know, Either this entire industry, you know, goes to zero, which we think is a very low probability, or it becomes significantly bigger than it is today. There's estimates out there that the cannabis industry as a whole, especially given its pharmaceutical dimension, has the potential to be you know, as big as any other pharmaceutical subset out there. So it's really exciting for us to be looking at the space and monitoring, you know, new and exciting companies to invest in.
Great, thank you. Thanks Rahul, and thanks Felix, and thank you all for listening. Please like and subscribe, and of course you can find loads more investment ideas and insights at ii.co.uk. I'll be back next month for another episode of the ETF Show. Bye for now.